put in with Zion. I don't know if that's my point.
I heard that I saw other things you put in.
Okay. It's in a few pages back. Is this the old version?
No, this is what you put out.
What I put in? On the back page of that?
No, this is it.
This is the fake drawing. This is the real drawing.
This is the one of two versions
in the Nachal Sheva.
Okay.
They reprinted the Nachal Sheva. A three-volume
Nachal Sheva?
Yeah, with Perushim on the bottom.
Right.
In the library, in reference.
When did it come out?
I don't know. I just saw it on the show. I'm looking for this.
Okay. We owe Rabbi Haber a Yashokaya for a new and expanded version of the Maamar Famous, including at the very beginning a whole list of citations, even underlined, that make it facilitate your going over the Maamar Famous. Let me make a few general comments. Number one, I take it for granted that it's not necessary to cover Hilchus Ishus or Hilchus Kiddushin. I presume you're quite capable of doing that yourselves. And if not, anything else I have to say is superfluous. You shouldn't be here in the first place. What I will try to do is to highlight a few problems that come up that are not exactly dealt with explicitly in Shulchan Aruch and the Noisei Kelim. And what I'll try to do essentially is to analyze the issues without necessarily resolving each and every problem. In order to make it easier for you to resolve such problems, on page Roman numeral 3, there are a list of svarim that will be of some assistance, and they've been divided more or less into different areas. It's certainly not necessary for you to go out and buy and learn every line of every single sefer, but these are the kind of reference svarim that you should be aware of, and I'll just say a few words about each of them. Under the first heading, which is called Kloli, I gave you the two classic compendia, the Shulchan Ha'ezer and the Hazein Yishayo, that are like encyclopedic works on the Seder of Shulchan Aruch, and they summarize for you most of the Achrenim that had appeared before these Sforim were published. So those are general. Then, in the last 10-15 years, there has been a spate of Kitzurim with regard to Hilchus Kiddushin, etc., and you have them listed 3 through 11. To a significant extent, they are overlapping. I find the Inveh HaGefen in particular to be rather interesting and comprehensive. Hanisuyim Ki Hilchosom is a close second. The others are there, as is always the case. You'll find something in every one of them, but you know, it's not necessarily the case that you have to go through every one individually. Item number 8, I find interesting. It's Minhagi Yisrael Teirich Helik Dalid. It's much better than the old-fashioned Tami Minhagim. It's much more comprehensive. And here you have references to things that are necessarily halacha, things that are extra halachic, Minhagim, etc. It's there. Then the next 4, the Ksuba, deals with the Ksuba as stated. Number 1, the Tosefes Ksuba, which was written by Rabbi Kellermer, is particularly good if you want to know what the Ksuba is all about. Pshat in the Ksuba. It also has tables that will give you various shitas with regard to the value of Mosaim Zuz and Meizukukim Kesef. It's interesting. You will also, I'm not going to go through this at all, but you will also discover that it's not at all clear what the Ksuba really means in terms of the basic Yischaivus. There are at least 2 separate ways of interpreting the text of the Ksuba. I'm not going to talk about it because I prefer that you go and look at the sources. Then there's the Ksuba Ki Hilchosa, as well as the last one, the Tefes Ksubas, which will have different forms for the Ksuba. It is not the case that the text of the Ksuba was given to Moshe Rabbeinu on Har Sinai together with the Luchos HaBris. So you will find different texts of the Ksuba. And while, of course, Chodesh is also min HaTorah and it's not really necessary to put different clauses into a Ksuba if you can do it in a separate document, but you will discover, for example, that among the Eidos HaMizrach, where there was no formal tachem of Rabbeinu Gershon against polygamy, they managed to get it in through the back door by incorporating a clause in the Ksuba which forbade the chosen from taking a second wife without the permission of wife number one. And there were certainly cases, again, we're not going to talk about it, where it was in the interest of wife number one to permit the husband to take a second wife. Then there's a very nice, valuable sefer of Rav Tobliskis dealing with Sheva Brachas. He in particular has an interesting section dealing with Sheva Brachas in the case where the Kala, who's never before married, but is not a psula, a few other modern shilas such as those. Then you have what's called here, under the broad title, Nisuim im Psulim. It's Getzel Ellenson's little compendium, Nisuim Sholoi Kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, whom he dedicates to his wife, who is his wife Kedas Moshe v'Yisrael. Then item number 18 you may find very valuable, and that is a little compendium, Kuntres Oretz Loreo. As long as you're being Masada Kedushin in New York, we'll talk about how to write New York in Ksuba. But if you're going to be Masada Kedushin in the Orei HaSoda someplace, the first thing you want to know is whether the city has been Muchzak, Ksivas, Gitin, and or Ksubais, and what the author did was to compile a list of cities and the way in which they had become Muchzak for Ksivas, Ksubas. So it's, you know, this first place to look. Not every place is there, but it's there. The other, the classic sefer, which I'll refer to a little bit later, in fact, we have two pages, we'll get to it later today, is Beis Medrash Shem Ve'ever. If you're dealing globally, you'll find a lot more places there, but it has very few American cities for the very simple reason that most cities in America were not Muchzak L'Ksivas Gitin, and he has only those cities in which they were writing Gitin. What he did was to collect Gitin from all over the world and proceed to tell you how they wrote Gitin. So that's the Kuntres Oretz Loreo. And then, last but certainly not least, the Kitzer Nachlas Shiva. Rabbi Haber just told me that the Nachlas Shiva is now available in three volumes. I don't know what they managed to put into the three volumes, but this is the Kitzer Nachlas Shiva. It's a Kitzer of the single volume. You do not need a Hamadriach. All that you need is a Kitzer Nachlas Shiva. The Kitzer Nachlas Shiva is the Jewish rabbinic attorney's form book. You'll find the text for a Ksuba, text for a Noyim, Ksuba d'Irkese, and the Heter Iske, if you're looking for it, and the Shtar Chatzizachar, a few more such things. If the choice is which among all of those, the first thing that you do need is a Kitzer Nachlas Shiva, if not the whole Nachlas. The mile of a Kitzer Nachlas Shiva is that you can put it in your pocket and you can use it for Seder Kedushin. Although I notice, I probably shouldn't make the comment, but I will. Rabbi Haber included a text of a Ksuba with Nekudas. I make the same comment as I made before. If you need the Nekudas, you shouldn't be here. In addition to everything else, there are one or two places in which, I don't know, I'm not a grammarian, I'm not an etymologist, and the way that we pronounce what we call Gemara Lashon, what the scholars call Aramaic, is playing it by ear. We pronounce words of the Gemara the way we heard it from the Malamed, and I don't know, when we were 9, 10, 11, and there were some things are out and out grammatical errors. That's true. It's not Hayim in Macy, but Hayim in Mati. But I will never forget Rav Palmzacher and Lavrocha. I learned Gittin, I think I was 14 years old, and Rav Palm knew Diktuk. And I remember he began, was learning the Sukkiah And he says that the scholars will say that the pronunciation is Me'ayim Imati. They are right, but my Rebbe taught me Me'ayim Imesi, and I will pronounce it Me'ayim Imesi. So there are a couple of places, Miklimit al Kasvoy, I seem to remember the Nakudas there, Miklimit al Kapai or something, al Kapi. I only know what I heard, Mirabonon, Kishishoi, but it's there for whatever it's worth. The only reason I'm making the comment is because later I will refer to a text that has something I would prefer that you didn't use, but after all, everybody else out there is using the text that Rabbi Haber reproduced for you. It's not the one that I recommend with the kudus or without the kudus, and hopefully before the day is over, I'll explain why I don't particularly like that that text. Also, the addendum to that, Matrachtido, I say Matrachtido. I don't know what he had something else. I didn't recognize the vocalization. They are probably right, and I'm probably wrong. I state that in advance. I'm not the least bit concerned. I'm simply reading and repeating the Messiah as I received it, for whatever that's worth. Now, so that the clearly. And the point I was making before is that all that you really need is the Kitzur Nach Neshiva, which easily fits into your pocket. And it shouldn't take terribly long for you not to need that at all. I mean, after all you have to know is the text of Birchas Erusin and the Birchas Nesuin. In addition to being an explicit Gemara, which everybody knows by heart, I mean, how long will it take till you've memorized it? If you've the Ziknei Rosh Yeshiva don't stand there with a pony from which they read. But, beside the point. But in order to know how to write the dates, etc., the Kitzur Nach Neshiva is really all that you need. Okay, having said that, let me talk about some of the topics that are on the list. And what you have is a number of general headings. And they're Mar Mekemis, and most of those have been reproduced in this little booklet. So let me begin from the beginning. First of all, Shiduchim, also known as engagement blahs. The first comment I'll make has absolutely nothing to do with anything which is in the Mar Mekemis. It's just a matter of curiosity and of interest. Engagements, insofar as Halach is concerned, don't exist. But Shiduchim, Noim, we'll talk about in a moment, but what in America was known as engagement at one point presented an interesting and significant problem that Rav Henkin in the Eidus Yisrael speaks about. Now, these are things of which I have no first-hand knowledge, although Karavina Talia, I heard people talk about these things. Apparently in this country, among some circles, engagement parties were big deals. And if you want a description of that, in more recent years I came upon a description in a book. It was written by J.J. Schechter and Jeffrey Urach. I forgot the title. I won't tell you the title. I want to forget the title. But it contained inter alia a description of how some rabbis once upon a time comported themselves when they were ambulance chasers wanting Seder Kedushin and the fee that accompanied it, and how they tried to ingratiate themselves by going to engagement parties. And apparently, Minig America at the time was that the Chosen presented the Kala with an engagement ring, Bifnei Am Ve'edom. And Rav Henkin, Zochron Lavrocha, was afraid that that might just constitute kiddushin, that the engagement might then require a get. And he talks about it in the Eidus Yisrael. It's interesting. I certainly didn't include it because, to the best of my information, it has fallen into disuse. Yishtakach hadavar. Forget about it. Forget about the institution of this public transfer of an engagement ring. Now, what I do want to talk about is tznoyim, and here you're dealing with something which is significant. The tznoyim have a long history. They served a purpose in days gone by that they don't longer really serve, and as a result, there have been different practices that have arisen with regard to tznoyim. basically a tenoyim. Remember that the marriages were once upon a time arranged by parents, subject of course to veto by the chosn and or the kala, but there were negotiations before the tenoyim were written, primarily because people were marrying at a relatively young age. They were not necessarily setting up housekeeping independently, and besides everything else, people weren't getting married with law degrees and medical degrees and smicha in their pocket and able to go out in the big world and earn a living. Whatever these people were doing, they were being supported in that endeavor by the parents, either one set of parents or the other set or both, and all of this had to be negotiated in advance. So the tenoyim were significant. Of course, that aspect is much less significant today, and if there are such negotiations going on, nobody wants to publicize them by recording them in the tenoyim. Nevertheless, the institution of tenoyim has remained. It has remained, and I hear tell, people tell me, that of course you need tenoyim. And they have a Gemara Mefereshes. Rav Mangi, the Mandakodish, Veloy Shiduche, and Rabbi Haber included the aphorism. I think it's number one, Kiddushin Yud Beis Amud Beis, and he gave you the text. It's the first item on page 1a. Rav pronounces a curse upon somebody who is Mekadesh without Shiduche. So how could anybody dream of getting married without writing Noyim? Those are the Shiduchim. Now that sounds very nice. 2 points. Number one, I'm not sure that that's what Rav Mangid means. Obviously, you need Shiduche. Rav was Mangid because he didn't want a phenomenon known as the drunken sailor syndrome. Incidentally, it has its parallel in things that will be drawn to your attention if you ever are Masada Kedushin in the city of New York. You of course, know all about the need for a marriage license, and you also know that you're going to perform a marriage ceremony in the city of New York as distinct from the state of New York. You have to register in City Hall. I won't talk about that aspect. I'm not interested in that aspect at all, but though that's the requirement out there. Whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, whether I believe that it's constitutionally valid is irrelevant. Obviously, I have a position. I'm not going to bore you with it in this forum. But you will discover that when you are presented with a marriage license, it is stamped by the city clerk, not only with the date, but with the hour. And that's because there is a legend which says that it is valid on 60 days, 90 days. I haven't read one of these in years. But it also says that it's not valid within the first 24 hours. That's what I referred to before as the drunken sailor syndrome. The city fathers, in their wisdom, were afraid that a sailor could get off a ship and frequent the bars, which are in the wharf area, and not knowing what he's doing, decide he wants to get married, and if he's allowed to go through with this, he wakes up tomorrow morning and regrets it all, or worse, he absconds and leaves a civil aguna. I'm not sure they were worried about the second. They certainly didn't want the first. So in order to prevent that from happening, they required a 24-hour delay. They didn't want people acting precipitously. That, lahavdil, is exactly what was the concern of Rav. That's why Rav Mangi, Aman Dekodish B'lo Shiduche. This is something to be undertaken with Ritzinus. I don't think he was really worried about drunken sailors, but after all, it's called Kiddushin, and you will be making speeches about the sanctity of marriage. We'll talk about what Kiddushin is later, but if this is something holy and sacred, you don't undertake it lightly, so you've got to do it with Kevod Rosh, so you need these Shiduche. Fine. Now, how do you fulfill the requirement of Shiduchin? I am aware of ancient ksubis. They found them in the Cairo Geniza and who knows where. Correct me if I'm wrong, not that I'm really interested, but I'm not aware of ancient tenoyim. I don't know of a form that was sold in Surim Pumbedisa that had on it, this was the Nusach HaTnoim of Rav, who was Mangi Daman HaKodesh without this Nusach. I'm not aware that there was such an ancient Nusach. That may well have been. I think that all that Rav wanted was the Mesinus, the Ritzinus, the Yishuv Hadas, the proposal, you know, some kind of a delay involved in all of this. In which case it doesn't have to be reduced to writing. Now I submit that if you are being Mesader Kiddushin, that means that somebody had to make a phone call to ask you to be Mesader Kiddushin, and if you did your job properly, you had a prenuptial interview with the Kallah and the Chosson and spoke about all kinds of things. And just as they called you, they also called people who are much, much more important, like the caterer and the photographer, and somebody had to arrange for the payment of those individuals, and that seems to me to be shiduche. Deciding who pays the caterer, was the Chosson's father, or the Kallah's father, or who knows who was paying the caterer, seems to me to fulfill Rav's requirement for shiduche. I'm not even talking about the couple has decided where they're going to live, and assigned the lease, and somebody is guaranteed the first and the last month's rent, and somebody is buying furniture, etc., etc. All of that sounds like shiduche to me. So the need for something in writing seems to me to be superfluous. But why in the world should I deny somebody a chumrah? If they want to have it in writing, let them have it in writing. But that's only if it's not a chumrah, the osi lidei kulo. The chumrah is an osa de kula for a very good, very simple reason. Now, once upon a time, tanoim were written sometime long before the wedding, obviously, which had to make all these preparations. In this country, and in Europe, my impression is, either you wrote tanoim or you didn't write tanoim. In this country is now the fad to write tanoim immediately before the chuppah. Why immediately before the chuppah, and why bother altogether? If you're going to get married 10 minutes later, then what do you need it for? So you need it for Rav Mangi Dama Kodesh Boi Shiduchi. Okay. There's a better reason for that. It's a photo op. The photographer takes pictures, and you have three kibbutim. You've got two people signing the tnaim and somebody else reading the tnaim. So it's wonderful for everybody. So what's the problem? The problem is the Chamudei Daniel, which Rabbi Haber also has reproduced for you, at least he gave you the salient citation. The Chamudei Daniel says that the counting of Shiva Nidim, it's item number 3, right? It's a Piskei Tshuva, quoting Chamudei Daniel, the Blek Siva Satnoim Loi Mahani Shivonikim Tzricho Limnais Mechodosh, that you have to count Shivonikim only after the Ksiva Satnoim and not before. Now, the Chamudei Daniel, no pun intended, was concerned with Dam Chimudei. And he knows the Chazal said that Tavul Limasei, you need Shiva Nikim because maybe she was Pirsonida at the time that she accepted the proposal. That's clearly what the Chamudei Daniel is concerned about. Now, let me try to understand the Chamudei Daniel and whether or not it is at all applicable to this, the Tanoim that people write immediately before the wedding. The Chamudei Daniel is concerned with Dam Chimud, and the question is this in terms of a Mitzius, is it empirical, or is his concern in terms of the formality? That the Tavuli Nosei, Shehadid, Shiva Nekim, it's a Takonis Chazal. And does he think that the Takonis Chazal is triggered by the Ksivas Atanoim? If it's a takonas chazal, then it's there's nothing we can do about it. If he thinks that it was triggered by ksiva satanoim, that's what's called tavul inosei, so we can things off a little bit. Who says this is tavul inosei? Tavul inosei was before. He may call this a nutvia, and the nutvia also requires it. there is at least one person that was one of the Zikner Rosh Yeshiva of the previous door. It's not Biksav, and I did not hear it from him. And he warned me never ever to repeat things in his name that I didn't hear from him, because all too often things are incorrectly repeated. It was on one time when I questioned about something that was repeated in his name, and he proceeded to hear me out very carefully and tell me, of course, I'm right. So when I asked him, so why did Rosh Hashiva say such and such, he just looked at me and said, David, etc., etc., it's all came when his claim was there at my moment, side nehertis from Michalein. In any event, I was told that this person, when he was confronted in America with this new minute, Chadoshi Mikorovbo, to write Noyim, before the chuppah, that he insisted on being an aid on the tnoim and proceeded to passel the tnoim. Now, he clearly agreed with me, what I said before, that you don't need these tnoim altogether for Avmangid, and if these people want the prophet, they're crazy chumras, he's not going to have any part of it. He was concerned with the Chamudi Daniel, and he thought that the Chamudi Daniel was under the impression that it's a kind of technical requirement if there are tnoim, and if he can passel the tnoim, there never were tnoim. If there never were tnoim, the only sheet of the king. However, I submit that the Chamudi Daniel may have meant something else. Now, clearly, this Rosh Yeshiva disagreed with my interpretation of the Chamudi Daniel. I think that the Chash of the Chamudi Daniel was entirely empirical. And I understand the Chamudi Daniel because I probably am privy to some things that this Rosh Yeshiva may not have been aware of. And that is that it's now known to all Meiri Heroa that despite the best laid plans of mice and callus not to have a chuppas nida, you do have a chuppas nida. It occurs, if you don't take precautions, it occurs in at least 50% of all cases. Why is easy to understand. The gynecologist will explain to you. I have even coined a name for this syndrome. I call it kalaitis. Kalas become rather emotional, probably even more so in America than Europe, because the wedding is a big deal, and you're worried about the caterer and the photographer and the band and this, that, the other thing, things that didn't occur to anybody in Europe, and the result is they become nervous and high-strung, and it's elementary that the menses are controlled by hormones. Hormones are controlled by emotions, and we have thrown all these emotions, things get out of whack. And the result is that you very often have a chuppas nida. In a minute I'll talk about whether it's a good idea to try to prevent a chuppas nida by using what's called the pill in order to control the menses. But I think that this is exactly what Chazal understood when they said that you have to be cheshish for dam chimud. They realized that the emotion of agreeing to marriage, accepting the proposal, could trigger the menses, and therefore they were cheshish. That's what Zakon is all about. That's what Tovu Alanosa is. It's explainable in the most simple and rudimentary of ways if you're aware of the medical reality. I think that the Chamudei Daniel was cheshish. That if you're writing to Noyim, the Kala, particularly if she is knowledgeable, and today Akshadora, more and more Kalas are more and more knowledgeable. She knows very well that till now it was a kind of a spiel of one kind or another, but now it's serious. And precisely why it's serious, I'll talk about in a second. And now this is really serious business because we're writing Tnoim. Who knows what happens in terms of the intricate balance at the time that she enters into Kabbalah Skinyan for the Tnoim. I think that's what the Chamudim is worried about, in which case the fact that you pass the Tsuba doesn't make the slightest difference unless the Kala knows that you pass the Tnoim. It all depends upon her perception. If so, then passing the Tnoim isn't going to make the slightest difference. I think that was really the concern of the Chamudei Daniel. Well, then, what do you do? If you're really chleishish for the Chamudei Daniel, you think that this is what the Chamudei Daniel meant, then why write Tnoim altogether? As I said before, some people think it's absolutely necessary. Is it possible to have your Chumra eat it, cake, and eat it too? I think the answer is absolutely yes. And again, I never spoke to Rav Moshe about it, but I am absolutely convinced that Rav Moshe, when he composed the text of the Tnoim that you will find in the end of the package, that he, it's got a page number, doesn't have a page number, doesn't have a number.
Four pages from the end.
That's Rav Moshe's Nusach HaTnoim. Rav Moshe's Nusach HaTnoim is design number one, not to make a chukah of a tlula out of it. The Tnoim talk about all kinds of things, and you have the real text, what Rabbi Haber called the real Tnoim on the previous page. And what does this have? This has a kind of, it says, it has a kviyas man, and it says it provides for a stipulated amount, etc., etc. The general text that you can buy in the Svarim store have k'medubor, what we ever agreed. That's because nobody wants to record all of this. And you know, the entering into an obligation to provide a cash payment, to provide for clothes, etc., 10 minutes before the chuppah doesn't make very much sense. And Rav Moshe simply has a text that says that the parties have already. This is like a kind of acknowledgement. It's a text which says that the parties have performed all that they have promised, which may or may not be true, but that's what it says anyway. And from the chosen to the kalah, there may be cases where they don't want to sign this. The only thing that's left over is to march down the aisle. And then you have the signature. If you look at it, it looks as if this was composed simply because otherwise it looks like a total and complete farce. But you will note that there is something crucial which is missing here. If you look at the text of the Tnoim, so Rabbi Haver gave me one that doesn't have it. The Chais Mishnei Edim. Did you drop the last couple of lines, or isn't it there in the Nachushiva? It's not there. I certainly don't remember.
The
Cherem part is here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sure, of course. But the printed text, the printed text that you will buy will have under the Chesim HaSvaidim a kind of a little Nusach, and then there is the signatures of the Chosn and the Kala. That was de rigueur in all Tanoim that I have ever been present at. And Rav Moshe omits it. If he omits it, there's a reason. And I'm telling you the reason. The reason is, he doesn't want the Kala to know anything about it. He's worried about the Chabulit Daniel. If you do it with two Edim, it's in the, what they call the Chosis dish, when the Kala isn't here, the two Machatenistas can break their plates, and you can have a Chesim HaSvaidim, and you can have a photographer, and it's all without the Kala, so there's no Tavua L'Nosei. The Kala doesn't know anything about it. If the Kala doesn't know anything about it, then there can't be any Dam Chimud. So that's the Chumrah of the Tnoim. Why, and why do people write Tnoim now before the Chuppah? Why not write the Tnoim weeks, months before, the way they did it once upon a time? That undoubtedly is the result of the fact that, unfortunately, just as the divorce rate has gone up in the general community, it has, by the same Arabi, gone up in the Jewish community as well, accompanied by an increase in broken engagements. Now, the broken engagement is serious in halakha. Rabbi Haber says that he gave you the crucial text. Haknas liftos acheru v'acherem liftos haknas. The Nusach HaTnoim refers to a cherem for violating the conditions of the Tnoim, primarily not showing up at the chuppah. This corresponds to what in common law was a tort called breach of promise. Probably wasn't a tort, it was probably a breach of promise, was like a contract. But you could sue for damages even in the state of New York until the mid-1930s. Mm-hmm. In Halacha, there was the provision for a knas, and both the Chachmei Svarad, as quoted by the Rambam, and the Bali Atesis had a problem with regard to how can you collect the knas. It's an asnachta, and I won't talk about the resolution of that problem today. the Chachmei Svarad resolved it their way, which is not incorporated in the text of Art Noyim. The Baalei HaTosfos had their own explanation of how it's actionable, but there's also this provision for the Cheirem, and paying the fine doesn't exempt you from the Cheirem, and accepting the Cheirem doesn't obviate the Knas or the fine. Now, the Cheirem, we don't know what this Cheirem is all about. There's a Chuvin of Sam Sofer, his copyright Chuvin, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but he talks about the Cheirem that you find in the Sharblot of Svarim that were printed in Europe in the post-printing press age, involving a Cheirem for anybody who is Masik Vul, reprints the Sefer without permission. And Sam Sofer wants to know, where does that Cheirem come from? He tells us it's a Cheirem HaKadmoni. Who these Kadmonim were, I don't know. They couldn't have been before 1450 because there was no printing press before 1450. No need for a Cheirem, so I don't know. It's lost in the obscurance of history. But he says, just like the Cheirem of the Tnoim. And where does this Cheirem come from? There, it's really ancient from time. Also, Rav Mangi, I don't know. But there was a Cheirem that was pronounced against somebody who violates the Shiduchim once you've entered into them, and you're dealing with a matter which is very serious. And is there any way to be released from the Cheirem? In some circles, there's the notion that as long as the Chosn and Kala are Michael, and they write a Mechila, that the Mechila constitutes an abrogation of the Tnoim, and hence there's no Cheirem. The Gro did not agree. The Gro maintained that there was no way that you could obviate the Cheirem unless one escape hatch was that if there was some factor present which could be Mechayev Get, if it's Kefil Lagarish, well then obviously you don't have to get married. So he thought that if there was some factor that would be grounds for Kviyan Gerishin, then the Cheirem doesn't apply. Otherwise, Mechilas don't help. His only Eitzah was to get married and to write a Get afterwards. You'll find all of that discussed, I think, I don't know which one of these, but it's probably in the Hagefen and or the Suin Gil Chosom, you will find discussion of what happens when the Chosn and Kala don't want to get married anymore, and it's after the Ksivas Atnoi. That was the serious problem, and I'm convinced that's why in this country the institution of Tnoim pretty much became abrogated, but then the people suddenly wanted Tnoim because they thought it was absolutely necessary, and I think they thought it was because of Rav Mankid, so what do you do? So they came up with this Eitzah of writing the Tnoim right before the Chuppah, and then we have the Chamudi Daniel, and so you're left with whatever it is that we are dealing with, and why I think that if you are going to have Tnoim before the Chuppah, use Remoshes Nosach, not necessarily for the reasons that are obvious. I think the less obvious but more cogent reason is the Chashash of the Chamudei Doniel. Now, I said I would say a word or two about regulating the menses in order to prevent Chuppas Nidah. I understand that that's very popular out there. I know the Ramosh himself wasn't happy about it. He wasn't happy about it because, to quote him verbatim, this I heard from him. He was concerned about which vestas to be pleshish for afterwards. I pointed out to him that l'shitosai, he maintained that any woman who is on a pill requires a moich dochuk for at least 30 days. I don't know how you have a moich dochuk if the young lady is still a psula, and it seemed to me that if her moish was cheshish for intramenstrual spotting, and it certainly in those days was a chash ritzini, I think it's still a chash ritzini, but the chash is now statistically less than it was once upon a time because the dosage of the hormones has been cut significantly. But if you're worried about a tipas dam that you're not going to find without a moich dochuk, then it seems to me if the psulim are still intact, you're not going to be able to make that kind of a bedikin. That's the chshailas of halacha. So it's a chshash. I hear teller Meir Hiro there who aren't chayshish for a moshe with the pill altogether. but I lost understand why they're not patients for remission. But apart from that, there is a medical consideration. Doctors, I'm told, advise that a woman shouldn't become pregnant for 3 months after going off the pill because of the possibility of congenital defects that are the product of having been on the pill. Whether that is, medically speaking, a chashash ratzini or not, I will leave it to the doctors. I'm not sure that the chashash is as strong in the case of a kala who's been using it for a couple of months at most, whereas all the studies are on women who've been on the pill for 10, 20 years and often longer, and no one has ever done a study of kalas who have been on the pill for a relatively brief period of time to determine whether they are at greater risk for congenital abnormalities. That's a medical issue. Talk to a doctor. In any event, I'm not so sanguine about trying to control the menstrual period in anticipation of a wedding in order to prevent a chupas nida, but those are the problems. Okay, yes?
The rabbi mentioned that if the couple is careful, then they can avoid a chupas nida.
That's what I meant. Careful by using the pill.
Okay.
Yeah, medically you can do it.
Okay.
Absolutely. You can control menses. There's not the slightest problem controlling them. It's the easiest thing in the world today. Which, you know, it's got a silver lining. It's not for us, it's not what we're talking about here. The silver lining is that when you have women with a short menstrual cycle, which once upon a time presented problems with going to the mikveh, and you've got chuvas nechsam sefer, what do we do with shiva nekiim for these women, v'chule, today that's a non-starter. The doctor prescribes a pill, and you have a longer ovulation, a period between ovulation, and that's not a problem anymore. That, you know, for that, the pill works like a charm. Whether it creates other problems in halacha, including intramenstrual spotting, which you have to be chayshish for, that's the other side of the coin that you have to worry about separately. Okay, yes?
Is it important to continue Dutai because of it?
Continue what?
To Dutai because it seems to be accepted. They're not getting a woman come along down, she's not going to bother.
Look, I think I made it very clear that I don't think they're necessary at all. I mean, but after all, I'm a reform rabbi. Don't you know that? I'm telling you that you don't need to know anything. What kind of... Jerry, tell that to a Hungarian Bahut. What should I do? That's what I said. Why should I deny people their chumras if I can find ways to eliminate the real shushes? And I think that that's what Rav Moshe did. I think that's what he was concerned with when he made that text to be used immediately before the hook.
I've heard many rabbanim recommend in terms of avoiding chupas nida. I think it's called progesterone only pill that delays the onset of the cycle rather than regulating in advance for 3-4 months. Rabbi Avraham.
Every pill operates by delaying the cycle. It prevents ovulation, which prevents, we've got a doctor asking that, which prevents other things from happening. What I suspect you're doing is you're using one of the hormones, not in combination, because there's a lesser chance of intramenstrual spotting. In theory, if you use the whole package, a woman never has to have a period. The women are having periods, in the old days they used to say this for psychological reasons. Now, the last stuff I read, and there was recently a summary of all this in the Science section of the New York Times. There may be even, maybe a good idea medically to have a period every once in a while. But now the movement is not monthly, but a couple of times a year, what have you. But whatever. I mean, the real issue that you're pointing out is that if you use some pills, the chances of intramenstrual spotting are much less than if you use other kinds of pills. I don't have studies. Neither does anybody else. For a very simple reason. Nobody's ever done such studies. It's all medically innocuous. Now, if somebody will use Rav Moshe's Eitzah with the modified hormone protocol in X number of women, and it turns out that they haven't had intramenstrual spotting, then obviously don't have to be chayshish for it. I'm not aware that it's even been done informally, so that's confusing. Okay. Any other questions with regard to tonight? Okay? One other item dealing with Shiduchim until we get to the Chuppah. And before we write to Noyim, you got to be sure that you want the Shirach. And you have problems with names. Kala v'chamisa, Chosin v'chaisna. Kala's got the same name as our future mother-in-law, and the Chosin has the same name as his future father-in-law. Now, the major source for all of this is the Savor Rebuta HaChosid, which I gather Rabbi Haber has also reproduced for you, although I haven't seen it. But I gather that this section of the Savor Rebuta HaChosid has been included in your package. I will just parenthetically state that people seem to take Kalo v'chamoiso even more seriously than Chosin v'chosnoi, and that seems to be because conditions of Savor Rebuta HaChosid, it was found in the Kalo v'chamoiso, yes, Kalo v'chamoiso was found in the Kisvei Huari as well. Now, I will briefly accept that there is some kind of hakpode with regard to these the identity of names, and try to talk about why and the so-called heterim that obviate the consideration. As best as I can tell, there are four possibilities or four explanations. And depending upon which explanation you accept, some of the heterim make sense and some of them don't. I'm not going to try to relate the heterim to the particular theory that has been advanced for the Tzavor Rebuta HaChosid, but you'll be able to figure it out yourself. First of all, Kabbalah, who knows? Alpi Kabbalah, this isn't a very good idea. So if it's Alpi Kabbalah, then the Eitzah, or I shouldn't say Eitzah, because I don't like it as an Eitzah, but the Heter is a Heter Meruvah. And that is that if either party has two names, you don't have to worry about it. So that if the name of the father-in-law is Moshe Chaim, and the Chosin is only Moshe, only Chaim, there's no problem at all. And the reason for that in Kabbalah is easy to understand, and that is that in terms of Kabbalah, there is no such thing as two names. Two names are one name. And if a person has been given Avram Chaim as the name, then his name is Avram Chaim, and Alpi Kabbalah, whatever a name does, it's the name Avram Chaim that's doing it. Now the name Avram doesn't do it, the name Chaim doesn't do it, it's Avram Chaim, a brand new name. Shema is Kadosh is Boloka instead of Koni Kadosh. That works in other areas as well. I don't want to dwell on it. But in terms of Kabbalah, naming after an individual is only if you give that person's name. If you combine it or you chop it in half or what have you, whatever it's supposed to do in Alpi Kabbalah, the people who know these things, something about these things, I know absolutely nothing about it, tell me that it's meaningless. But it may be meaningless in terms of Kabbalah if it makes people happy. There may be even more reasons to do things like this. But in any event, the first kula with regard to the names is that if the name is in any way different, because there are two names on one party and the other person is only one name, there's no problem at all. Number two, the second reason that's been given is problems of kibud oath. Calling the chosn or the kala by the same name as that person's father or mother or what have you, that is a pshayl of halacha. In order to avoid that, the shidduch was not advised in the first place. Now, obviously, this is not a serious consideration if the people have a shem laz, which is used to the exclusion of the shem kodesh. Bahrein Hussein Harabi might hear tell that out there, Shinu Eshemam. Now, there are people who don't use the Hebrew names. And the father from the last generation, they called him Avram, but this person they're calling Arthur, even though his Hebrew name was Avram. And if the Kala is always going to call him Arthur, then there'll never be a problem of calling him Arthur in her father's presence. Her father's name's Avram. Her father's name's not Arthur. There's no inherent lack of kibud ov in using that name. So you have lots of Akharinim who say that if there is a Shem Laz, there's no problem at all. The other third reason is that there was really a consideration of halacha involved of all of this, and the problem was a miksha. And you have to remember that in days gone by, people did not have electricity, and there were no street lamps. And at night, if you put out the candle, it's pitch black. And if in the middle of the night you call your husband or your wife by name, and a father-in-law or a mother-in-law responds, the result can be terrible. And in order to avoid that, you don't marry somebody with the same name. And they weren't willing to rely on Tvias Ayin Dekolo. The Tvias Ayin Dekolo was, you know, maybe... You know, it may work in most cases, but apparently some people were chayshish for all of this. So that was the other chash. Yes.
That chash directly contradictory to the previous one.
Maybe.
Call your parent.
Yes.
Ima or Abba.
No. She wants to call her husband, but she calls by name, and the father thinks it's the mother.
Okay.
Sure. Okay. And the incidentally, in one of these compendia, that I don't remember where I saw it anymore, but I saw someplace a shidduch that took place between two Hasidic Rebbeshe families, a blue blood shidduch. And of course, these people didn't make inquiries in advance about such mundane things as a name. The host and the Kala had met each other, but the Machatonim, the two Rebbes, were sitting and they were ready to write to Noim. And they suddenly discovered that the Kala's name was the same as her future mother-in-law's name. And they were about to break the shidduch when the father of the Kala asked his Mechutin, tell me your wife's Hebrew name again, and he repeats it. And he asks her in Yiddish, "Umvi Ruthmanir," what do people call her? And the answer is Rebbetzin. So he gives a pasha on the table and says, "Mazel tov, she has a different name. Her name is Rebbetzin." So there's no problem. It's like a different name. Okay, so the other explanation, and that is the native Yehuda, is that this was because of the possibility of sakona. Now, it may have been, this is what the Kabbalistic notions were all about, but the Neidib Yehuda says that if it was Kabbalah, or if it was sakona better, that it was limited to the descendants of the Rebbe Yehoshua himself. Let me make one other point before I forget it, and that is the Tshuva Nechsam Sefer, which is also in the package. I don't remember the page numbers anymore, but they were clearly indicated in the where are we? It's Beis, Nechsam Sefer is page 74, Nechsam Sefer is page 48. The Nechsam Sefer says it's only Mishuloshim, three generations in a row. A father, a son-in-law, and a grandson-in-law have the same name. Two generations, he says, doesn't make any difference. But I am more concerned with the Nechsam Sefer, which is 74, and I am concerned with the Nechsam Sefer, not primarily with regard to this Shaila, but with regard to something entirely different. The Nechsam Sefer is writing to a Talmid who is concerned because somebody had proposed a shidduch for her brother-in-law, and the name of the chosen was the same as the prospective kala's father's name. And he was worried about the tzavah of Rebbe Yehuda HaChosid. So the Nechsam Sefer responds, Da talmidecha achovi v'yudvorim alolu chukukim alu achlid b'cho l'zikorin aklala godl shen l'chol chachomim shachar talmud rishus loimar dover neged ha-talmud v'imer dover lister kutzi shel yud probably midivri ha-talmud lo yechoshev b'chlal chachme Yisrael. Don't come and tell me Tav l'meitav tandu l'meisav amalo was once upon a time and not now. V'chule, v'chule, v'chule. V'oimer dov alister kutze yud medivir ha-talmud l'yichoshev. I'm sorry, I read that. Omnom, kishonu meitzim echo mechachme Yisrael, ha-muchzak b'teir b'yira b'li sofik, to the exclusion of other people of whom these appellations could not be written. Shekosa b'sefer dover hasis l'divrei ha-Talmud chayovim on l'mshkuni nafshu l'taris dvorov sheloi diberak l'shon l'mishpoch protis v'divrei ha-Talmud heim al haklal. How do you explain the contradiction? The Gemara is talking in generalities, and they're talking about a specific case. Every things that you have as generalities in Gemara can have individual exceptions, and these people are talking about individual exceptions. He then goes on to cite other seifim in the Tzav Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. He says that he writes dvorim shikamat osra lon l'shemam hu omar shlo yisa basachesai. So, if this is a general statement for Buda Chosid, also the Kabbal Dvar of Klal. Avol Emesir, Darkin proceeds to say that Yehuda HaChosid is only Zari Achrov because he knew Beruach HaKodesh, Shezari Liatzleach Bezivugim Ke'elu. And he knows that his progeny, there will be Shiduchim that won't be successful. And the only simon that he had was the name. So in those cases, he said, don't get married and you'll spare yourself a lot of heartache. So that's number one. And he says at the very end, about five or six lines from the bottom, Milvat calls it. I don't think I have to add any additional commentary. I already told you I'm a Reform rabbi, but this time I'm at least in good company with the native Yehuda. One thing that I will add, and that is that in some circles they suddenly decide that they're going to add a name, usually for the Chosin or for the Kal instead of for the last generation. That is certainly not to be recommended. There is one place in the Igros Moshe, I don't remember offhand, the Simen, I don't know if I included the Marmukimus or I didn't, Rav Moshe, without explaining, says that he does not advise adding names in order to avoid the problem of the Tzavor Yehuda HaChosid. Now, the reason not to do this, and I'll speak a little bit more about it later when we talk about Seamus Laz in a Ksuba, the reason is absolutely perfectly obvious. Number one, you may end up with a Ksuba that's possible. Number two, forget about the Ksuba that's possible. You may end up with problems in being Mesader Get, if, heaven forfend, that becomes necessary. The problem with adding names to make a mechutin happy or some aged grandparent happy is that this is done lefonim. You promise, yes, we're changing his name. We'll call him by the new name, by two names. It lasts from Tinus Esther until Purim. And it's, everything is forgotten, and you call the person by the original name. A true Shinui Hashem is a Shinui Hashem. And now you've got a problem on your hands. If you were Mishan Hashem, and how you're Mishan Hashem is not our problem today. But if you were Mishan Hashem, then the new name is the name, it's not the old name, and Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid would have had no objections whatsoever. My problem is, when you're going to write the Ksuba, which name do you use? Do you use the new name, the one you were Mishaneh, in which case the Ksuba is kosher only if you had a valid Shinui Hashem? Or do you write the old one, in which case, what have you accomplished, number one? And number two, if it was a valid Shinui Hashem, then you have a postal Ksuba. And who's talking now about 5, 10, 20 years later, when you're being the Sadr Get, and you want to know now at the time of the Get, which is the real name. You now have to be Machriah, whether there was a Shinui or there wasn't a Shinui. Now, how are you Mishan Hashem? You have to be Machzik Hashem. Without being Machzik Hashem, it's not going to help you very much. And how are you Machzik? I'm sure you Chuvas would say that they should make Mishaberach Sheni V'Chamishi for 30 days, and that's Machzik, the new name. I don't know of people who do that for purposes of Shiduchim. It's generally, they're not Machzik it that way. And if they would be Machzik that way, so fine. So it'll last until the Chuppah. And what's going to happen afterwards? Is this name going to be forgotten? Are they going to use the new name? Or now that we got married already and everything is fine, we can go back to whatever we did before. So you'll have to shaila later with the get. Was this new name Mishtakach? Or wasn't the new name Mishtakach? There are enough problems to being the Sadr and get without adding new ones. Who needs all of this? Particularly since I don't take the chash of the tzavor, all that seriously, other than for direct lineal descendants of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, and I don't know very many of them. So again, the changing names is certainly not something that Lanias Daiti should be encouraged. Again, you know, things are kind of a chumrah. I caution that chumrah is fine, wonderful, but not when they create michshelim, let alone kulis. Okay, that's all the preliminary business. We now are ready for writing the ksuba. The first thing with regard to the ksuba, I have here as item number 3, adopted children. I'm going to. None of this is in the package, apparently. And I'm sorry. What's not in the package is adoption itself, and that was, you know, appropriately omitted. The first year, I tried to cover adoption as well, and quickly discovered that there's not enough time for everything. So the propriety of adoption and what happens in terms of adoption, I don't really mean the propriety of adoption per se, although that also is a problem, but the status of an adopted child for purposes of shiduchim, whether he has a status of a shtuki, or worse, better, it's actually better, the status of a goy. I know what to do with a goy, take it to a mikveh. With a shtuki, I don't know what to do. Whether you've got problems or not in cases of ordinary adoption, nothing to talk about. I will briefly, next time, talk about how you write the tzuba for a child who's been adopted. But before we get to that, I want to talk about how to write Shemes Laz. And you need Shemes Laz for 3 different purposes. The first one here is a section in of itself. Ksivas Shem Kinui Mishpoche. And you have in Nigros Moshe, pages 10 to 12. And Rabbi Haber, I presume, probably unconsciously, but maybe was Freudian unconscious, didn't include the text of the Ksuba in this section, the one which has L'mishpachas in the text. Now, Rav Moshe says that it's unnecessary to write the Shem HaMishpacha. I consider it inadvisable and inappropriate. There are people there who think that it's necessary. I shouldn't say necessary. They think it's a good idea because in big cities there may be Shnei Yosef and Shimon, and if you have 2 Yosef and Shimon, you can't be Meitzim Momon with the Ksuba because each one will say it's not me, it's the other guy. And remember, 2 Yosef and Shimon means 2 Yosef and Shimon who marry 2 Dina Basleis because the both parties have to match. Rav Moshe says you don't have to worry about that. If it's Muchzak, if it's not Muchzak, the statistical probability is relatively infinitesimal, and you're not mechuyev b'cheshish at all. Now, why not write l'mishpachas, another chumra? The answer is, if you are a baki in Shemes Gittin, and you know how to transliterate Shemes Laz, be my guest, it can't harm. If you make a mistake, you ended up with a ksuba that's possible. And there's nothing easier than making a mistake in transliterating Shemes Laz. That's the major problem in Seder Gittin, and that's why you leave Seder Gittin to people who presumably are bucky in such things. That's why I consider it extremely inadvisable to attempt to write shameless lots. I have unfortunately seen more than one ksuba which I believe to be possible even with the evidence. Now, most of the shinuim that run-of-the-mill people are going to make are making with run-of-the-mill names, and the evidence will probably be kosher, but I once saw, it was a Rosh Hashiva Mufursim, who was with a Sadr Kiddushin for somebody who had a French name, and he didn't know any French, and he thought he pronounced it in English, and he proceeded to transliterate it as if it were an English name. And it's clearly that wasn't the Shem HaMishpacha. It's a different Shem altogether. You're asking for trouble if you try to write the Shem HaMishpacha. But having said that, you do have to know how to transliterate. Why do you have to know that? Or at least to be a mistapik vishoya. Why do you have to know that? Number one, if you're going to write the Shem HaMishpacha. Number two, for place names in places that were not yet muchzak l'ksivas gitin or l'ksivas ksubas. The rule with place names is that it's muchzak, even if it wasn't correct in the first place, you keep on writing the way it was supposed to be written. You keep on writing the way it's been muchzak. And I'll give you a couple of examples if you want. Yeah.
You must write it the way it was muchzak.
Must is a strong word. The practice is to continue writing, even though you, as the Mesader Kiddushin, will gnash your teeth every time you write it because you think it shouldn't have been spelled that way. I can give you a couple of examples in a minute. The third is if you are stuck with writing a Shem Laz because you have no Shem Kodesh. The Shem Kodesh was Nishtakach. It's not so hard for a Shem Kodesh to be in Shtakach. And you have Bavenesenu Harabi, people who grew up without a Shem Kodesh, and they acquired the Shem Kodesh someplace along the line. I have heard, and heaven forfend, nobody who has a smicha from this august institution, but I've heard tell of Mesadri Kiddushin, who on the chuppah, the kala's name is Susan, but of course she had that Hebrew name. Her name was probably Soros. They proceed to write Soros. If it happens at Levayas all the time, Levayas, I really couldn't care. I could care a little bit less. But since all that I'm dealing with is Yonim of Kabbalah, so no Nishkeferla, we got to make a Kel Moli Rachamim. And they don't remember what the mother's Hebrew name was. Her name was Sadie. What? So the officiant is embarrassed to get up and to make a Kel Moli Rachamim with a Chazonis and to say Sadie Bas, whoever. So he says, Sorabas. That's not what you do. I will tell you, Maisa Shehoya, I tell it every year. My first chuppah, I had a weekend shul. I was learning the koil, trying to keep body and soul together with a weekend position. And Eberschid Geholfen, I had a chuppah, I had to go be Mesader Kiddushin. It was the first time that I had this delight. And of course, I interviewed the chosen and the kala, and I had all the shamus. And I show up at the chuppah, and I begin writing the ksuba, and I begin writing Shlomo ben whoever it was, because that's what the parties told me that the name was. And I'm going to check now. Before it was only the chosen and the kala. Now I have the parents, and I have a grandmother here, and I turn to the grandmother, and I ask her, "Und wie ist der Inneklach in Yiddishen Nomen?" And she tells me his name is Shimon. He told me Shlomo. Whereupon I raised my eyebrows, and there's an aunt from the other side of the family sitting at the same table, and she begins raising her voice. His name isn't Shlomo. Hey, Shimon, not mein Vetter. Who knows why? And this woman starts screaming, "No, they gave him a name, Shlomo, after her." Women are ready to begin tearing their hairs out. As far as I'm concerned, it's clearly the Shem Arisa is clearly Nishtakach. If they're quarreling, nobody else knows the name, and there's no way that I'm going to write either of these names in this ksuba. So I begin writing a second ksuba. and nervous I am, so I managed to mess up the second suva. The second was totally my fault. So I tear up the second suva and I don't have a third one. Be prepared. Bring more than one extra. So I begin writing the ksuba in longhand. My Rosh HaKol, the president, you know, they're not, these presidents aren't around anymore. He was a shul yid from the Alta Haim, and he comes over and sits down and says, Rebbe, what's to him? So I tell him, I'm writing a ksuba. He says, what's to him? He's not. So I go, yeah, but I missed Fabulous. So I explained to him that these people can't agree what the name was, so I can't use the name. So I says, what's the writing? He says, I'm writing Stephen. That was his English name. Und wie wird er lehnen unter der Chuppe? Now what are you going to read? Tell me the lehnen, wie sie steht. I'll read what it says. So then, for the first time in my life, I was called by this appellation, Rebbe, me wird aber sagen, als ihr seid, a reform rabbi. My response on the spot was, because I had other problems with the shidduch, with this wedding, was, halavai, Mr. Charlov, halavai. Okay, but that also wasn't easy, because his name was Stephen. He spelled it S-T-E-P-H-E-N, not E-V-E-N. But fortunately, I knew that you go bust the Kriya and not the Ksiva, so we wrote a Ksuba with the Shem Lots. Now, European, hey, you'll have cases like this.
In English, or in English,
Stephen. We're writing in Ksav. I was writing Ksav Meshita. We're talking about Hebrew letters, right? How you transliterate? Sorry. Because you translate a PH. Steven is a vav and a Stephen is a pe. Right, it's pronounced with a V. That's how you pronounce the PH. In English, there are many things that are written one way and pronounced another way. English is not a phonetic language, and you've got to know the first principle is that you go bosar phonetics, not bosar the exceeding. But you will have this problem, number one, when they never had a Hebrew name, and they'll try to give them a Hebrew name. And number two, what's happened is that there are people who never got a Hebrew name, particularly girls. They didn't make a Mishaberach and a Kiddush and the whole parade and give them a name in shul, and this girl's going to Talmud Torah, or now day school, and the first grade, the teacher is embarrassed. She's got, what does she have in front of her? Little Susie. And how can she not have a Hebrew name? Everybody has a constitutional right to a Hebrew name. It's a divine prerogative of some kind or another. So the teacher assigns a name, begins calling her Sarah. It wouldn't bother me if everybody called her Sarah and nobody called her any other name. Then I'd have a little bit of a problem in the get. Do I use the English name first and this one second, since it's not a Shem Arisa, or the Shem Kodesh first and the Shem Blas second? But if I use either of the names to exclude you or the other, it's also kosher to the other. That's the least of my problem. My problem is that she left school after the eighth grade and nobody calls her Sarah anymore. And she comes to the chuppah, and the rabbi asks her Hebrew name, and she says, my Hebrew name is Sarah. If you don't ask any more, you're not going to gain more information. Don't ask, don't tell. If you ask, and where did you get this name from? She'll shrug her shoulders. It's why my parents told me. So presumably, that was the Shem Arisa, that was the Mishaberach and the Kiddush, and whatever comes with it. Or she says, that's what I gave the name they gave me in Talmud Torah. In which case, you know that you should be using the Shem Latz, not the Shem Kodesh. I don't know if it's in the package or not, but there's a Tshuva of Ramesha dealing with Susan. That was his example. And what right, she was a girl from America who went to Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael, nobody calls her Susan, and she wanted to get married, and Ramesha, we'll talk about it a little bit later, what to write in the Ksuba. Now in his case, I would have had no problems whatsoever. She's in Eretz Yisrael, everybody is now calling her Susan, whatever they're calling her. The fact that she has Susan in her passport, I don't think makes the slightest difference. She's now Musak as Sora, even if you wouldn't get right. Sora, the Hamachuna Susan, or Sunan is the Hamachuna Sora, for a Ksuba you can write Sora, no problem. Ramesha seemed to think that She's going to come back to America. She's going to become Susan all over again. And therefore, he wanted them to write Susan in the Ksuba. And I have the impression that he wanted it written in English letters, in Latin letters, rather than in Lashon Kodesh, which is altogether Loi Min HaMekubal. I'll talk more about that later, maybe. Yes?
Mr. Shadow, then I heard yesterday, it was in the OU, someone in the Ksuba wrote, her Hebrew name is Rachel, and they wrote Rachel Rachel Cohn. That's her last name is Cohn.
There is a problem. Yes, there is a problem. Now, again, I'm never.
She just one name. It's either Rachel or Rachel. They wrote both.
She wrote both, yes. And then with Masada, if he knew what he was doing, I don't know. Her name was Rachel Mela. I presume they gave her the name Rachel. And then they called her Rachel.
Something.
Maybe not. Because they may have called her Rachel, in which case they should have spelled Rachel. Later we'll see Rav Henkin says that if it's Rachel and Rachel, you can write Rachel anyway. But, and if it's Rachel and Rachel, there's no reason whatsoever even again to write Rachel ha-mochuno Rachel, because that's the English transliteration of Rachel. We don't write Avrom ha-mochuno Abraham. There are some that that's yochid among operating people, things like that. I have never seen any responsible Sadr didn't do that. So that A, this was a total mistake, he should have written just Rachel. And if he wants to write, write Rachel also, he should have written Rachel ha-mechuno Rachel l'mishpachas. You don't write the family name without the word l'mishpachas. That's altogether wrong. I don't know what he wrote there. But this isn't what you do. It's not what we do altogether. You want to know if it's possible that the Eved, Rachel Rachel, the people, anybody ever call her Rachel Rachel? It's not for today. Her name isn't Rachel Rachel. No, Rachel is not Rachel. Rachel is not Rachel. She's got a name Rachel. She's got a name Rachel. And she wants to say it's two names. So we know how to show that it's the same person with two names. It's not by name. The person's name is Avrom Chaim. And by that I mean some people call him Avrom and some people call him Chaim. That was the old-fashioned Shinui Hashem. They didn't add a name, but they changed it totally and completely. So if his name, Shem Arisa, was Avrom, and it changed because he was sick to Chaim, and everybody calls him Chaim today, and the Shem Avrom wasn't a shtakat, but everybody knows it was a Shem Arisa, you can write Avrom, you can write Chaim. Which one to be mad, you can worry about later. But if you write Avrom Chaim, it's not his name. It's a Shinui Hashem Mamish. And it's a... In this case, I'm not sure if it's Shinui Hashem Mamish. I think that the reader would probably realize that.
Yeah. Just to clarify that, it's more Nahog in Ksuvos, even though in Gittin you generally put in all the names in the
Kibbutz. Again, in Gittin we put in every name. Ksuvah, generally you don't use Kinui. You write only one name and no more. There are some cases where it may be necessary to write Amchuna or whatever. We can talk about that. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. And then in rare cases. And those are basically psychological.
But if it could be established, either due to the fact that they were born with a Hebrew name and they use it,
correct,
or that they got a Hebrew name later, but they use it. So even sure, though it's really in terms
if
of
the Hebrew,
usage,
if it's not
Ishtaka,
you see what happens is the girl who went to Talmud Torah for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So she remembers, my Talmud Torah teacher said my name was Sora. Right. Nobody remembers her name was Sora. Her parents probably never knew. And the kids in the Talmud Torah class, who knows where they are. Nobody else today knows her name was Sora. That's called Ishtaka.
But in Rebbe's view, if she has a Hebrew name, regardless of how she
Shem
got it,
Arisa.
Assuming it's not Ishtaka.
That's what I want to talk about. What makes the Shem Arisa Mishtaka? Now, this is it's my scene, Becholia. Contemporary society, going to any American shul, there are people, their name is Larry, Harry, who knows what, and they're illiterate, every Shabbos, they're fine, Shemri Shabbos, Shemri Mitzvah, they have Hebrew names, and the Shamas, the Gabbai, calls them by his Hebrew name. That name isn't Mishtaka. That's a Shem Arisa. It's not Mishtaka. It's another Shem also. But then you have people who had a name at the Bris, and if you're lucky, they used it at the Bar Mitzvah. And now, for the third time in their life, they showed up at the Kupit. Are you going to write this name, or are you not going to write this? I don't remember if this material is in the package or not. But the first person who wrote about this at length was the Binyan Seer Hank Ettlinger. It was in the Shem Ratzion HaNemon. And two different practices arose among Mesadre Gittin. There's what I call the standard practice, And then there's the practice of what, for lack of any other term, I call the Eastern Europeans. Most poskim, including the Olei Shem, follow the position of Yankov Etlinger. He says that this is a Shem that was given Lidvorim Shebekedusha. And by definition, it's not Mishtakach as long as the family remembers. They gave him the name for ritual purposes. They gave him the name for the bris, for the bar mitzvah, for the chuppah, and Lachem Eiv Esrim to put on a matzeva. That's not called Mishtakach. It was given for this purpose. The Shem Arisa, the cradle name, is the Shem Leikar, and as long as the family remembers it, and they're not quarreling about what the name was, you can use it without the slightest problem. I myself have seen gittin of people that fit into this description, in which the Mesader HaGet wrote the Shem Laz and omitted the Shem Kodesh. Not only that, I was Mesader Kedushim for one such gentleman, and I made the Ksuba for the second Zivuk Sheni with the Shem Kodesh and not the Shem Laz. And you'll ask me why. I mean, my reason is very simple. Number one, I would lose out of the get with the Shem Arisa and Hamachunin. That doesn't mean I'm right. They were choshish that the Shem Arisa is nishtakach, and the Shem that's nishtakach can passel the get. Only, what should I do? My Messiah is the Messiah of Rabbi Yankov Etlinger and the Olei Shem, and everybody that I ever saw do these things, and they considered it not to be nishtakach. But that doesn't mean that the Shem Laz would have passed. If you have written the Shem Laz alone, this also would have been kosher. So why was I writing the Shem Arisa Bedafke, the Shem Kodesh? Very simple reason. He sent out wedding invitations. And their wedding invitation he sent out with the Hebrew Nusach, with his Shem Arisa, the Shem Kodesh. I can't call that. Nobody asked him to. He didn't know what the Shalas were. He didn't know from anything. But he sent out with his Shem Arisa, the Shem Kodesh. I don't think even for the Hasidish that this is called the Shtakach. Only he didn't know what kind of a chasna brief he was going to send out afterwards. All he knew was that the guy wasn't from, and he knows that the guy doesn't go to shul. And Mestoma, the Shem is the Shtakach, so he remembers. Very nice. Who else remembers this family? Probably nobody else. But by the time he went to the chuppah, everybody who got an invitation knew what the Shem Kodesh was. That's one way to make a Shem. He was maxing the Shem with the invitation. So at least it seems to me that if we're dealing with the Shem Aris and Dr. Maxing it, simply want to make sure there wasn't a Shtakach, this should be enough to mean that it wasn't a Shtakach. So I repeat, you need to know how to transliterate A for cases in which you have to write the Shem Bo Yir and it's not Musak, B for cases in which there is no Shem Kodesh, or the Shem Kodesh is Besofik, and if you're going to write the Shem HaMishpoche, you've got to know how to do it, and I advise you to avoid the problems to the extent possible. And again, like I said before, if you're writing the Mishpoche and you know that his name is not Chaim Yankel, Weissman. It's the Mishpachas Weissman. You have to put in the word the Mishpachas before the Shem HaMishpacha. I think we went over 3 o'clock, huh? Okay, to be continued. What's that word? The others, I call them the Eastern Europeans presumed this to be the Shem that was Mishpacha.
I was next to grow up, I'm so redemptive, and we'll be coming in 2 Thursdays from today. Makeup day for the previous Lakena and Salem this Monday, which is the Arab Air Tours, so I think you'll be away, so we'll get another opportunity at the end.